This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. You may be shocked to learn what's living in your home. The bacteria, the fungi, viruses, parasites, and insects. Probably many more than you imagined. But if that makes you think you'd better start scrubbing right away, my guest Rob Dunn says the real goal is to create a healthy balance of all the microbes that cohabit with us. You might be upsetting that balance with some antimicrobial sanitizers. Dunn inventories microorganisms and insects in our homes the way other researchers might inventory the wildlife and rainforests. He and the team of scientists he works with analyze the populations of microorganisms living on floors, in basements, on water faucets, the surfaces of TVs, in HVAC systems, etc. They often work with citizen scientists around the country who swab parts of their home for analysis. Dunn is the author of the new book, Never Home Alone, From Microbe to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. He's a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen. Rob Dunn, welcome to Fresh Air. So I was prepared to learn that there would be bacteria and fungi in my home. I was prepared to learn that there was a lot of micro wildlife. I was unprepared to learn how much and how really creepy some of it was going to be. So let's start with just like an overview of like what's going on in our homes.
So every surface, every bit of air, every bit of water in your home is alive. And every house, every building we've ever studied, all of those things are alive. And so the only choice you really get is which life. And so when we study homes, different homes have different kinds of life in those different places. And so you look in the hot water heater, and there are microbes that are they've evolved to be able to deal with really, really high temperatures. If you look in your salt shaker, there are bacteria like bacteria you find in salt flats in the desert. If you look in your attic, there are interesting bugs in your attic that we don't see elsewhere. In your basement, you see cave animals. And so your house has habitats. Each of those habitats is a little bit different. And there are collectively across houses hundreds of thousands of species, but the average house has thousands of species. And if you breathe in deeply right now, Terry, just inhale, in that breath, what's in your lungs at this very moment are thousands of species. And a couple of them are bad news. Some of them you depend on. And most of them nobody's ever studied in any real way.
One of the things you've learned in studying the micro-ecosystem of homes is that there are microbes that live in the extreme environments outdoors in very cold temperatures or very hot temperatures that can live indoors because our homes reproduce the extremes of the outdoors through things like the freezer and the boiler. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so if you look at a traditional home from a couple of hundred years ago, it would have been relatively open to the outdoor environment, and the conditions in it would have been very much like the conditions outdoors, a little bit buffered, but very similar. But in our modern complex homes, we've built a whole bunch of little structures in the home that replicate really extreme environments from elsewhere on Earth. You know, our freezers are kind of like the Arctic. Our ovens are like really, really hot deserts. And so when we do that, we're creating habitat for species that like those conditions.
Last year, you were in Iceland filming a documentary near a bubbling, hot, sulfurous geyser. People studying the microbes of hot water taps and boilers in homes found similar microbes to the ones in this sulfurous geyser. So what are they, and what are they doing in our homes?
Yeah, so these are really amazing microbes that nobody saw them for many, many years, even though people looked in places like geysers, because when we study microbes, we often bring them into the lab, and we try to grow them in conditions that we think are nice. And so it's more or less like Florida temperatures. But these microbes actually can't grow at those temperatures. Their environment has to be really hot, close to boiling water temperature, to grow. And so it was only when people started to try to grow these microbes at really, really hot temperatures that they appeared. And so they were first discovered and geysers like the one I was near in Iceland. But later, the scientist who found them in Iceland and Yellowstone decided to look around his lab to see if in other hot conditions he might find them. And in the lab hot water tap, he was actually able to find some of the same microbes that are found in those geysers. And he would go on to show that if you go to laundromats, that the hot water heaters and laundromats are full of these microbes. And then if you turns out if you go to houses, in houses, hot water heaters are full of them too. And they live in that super hot water that we think is sort of sterilizing our water, and they love it. And they pour out of your hot water tap when you pour some hot water. They pour onto you when you take a shower. And they're fascinating little bugs.
Are they harmful to us?
They're not harmful in any way.
Another study that's been done is on the biofilm of shower heads. I mean, while we're talking about some of the things that happen in the bathroom. So tell us about what's going on shower heads.
Yeah, so if you unscrew an American-style shower head where you have the pipe going into the shower head and you can just unscrew the tip and then look into the shower head, what you'll see is a kind of gunk on the inside of the shower head. And that's a biofilm, which is kind of an apartment that that bacteria collectively excrete and then live in. And it keeps them buffered from the flow of water. And so they make that little apartment and they live there and they eat essentially the nutrients that are flowing in the water through the tap toward you. And so when you shower, that's right above you. And a little bit of that breaks off each time you're showering and sort of sprays down on you. And mostly that's harmless, but there's a group of bacteria called non-tuberculous mycobacteria, which are relatives of leprosy and tuberculosis. And those sometimes establish in those biofilms. And so a couple of years ago, Noah Feer and my lab and a group of other colleagues, we decided to study globally those little biofilms in showerheads to figure out why they sometimes seem to have these bad news bacteria and why they other times don't.
What did you find?
So the couple of simple take-homes. One is that people who are on municipal water supplies, so like Philadelphia, New York, that are heavily chlorinated, that chlorine seems to kill most of the bacteria in the water system, but it leaves those non-tuberculous mycobacteria alone because they're chlorine tolerant. And so it kind of creates a world in which they can live happily without much competition. On the other hand, well water from rural environments or municipal water from some of the European cities that don't treat their water with chlorine, the mycobacterium seem very, very rare. And so we're accidentally making them common by trying to kill everything.
You mentioned that some of these mycobacteria cause leprosy or tuberculosis. Are we breeding those kinds of bacteria in our shower heads? Would you like to reassure us?
No, we're not at risk of shower stall leprosy or tuberculosis.
Good.
It's just the same basic kind of life. The biggest risk from these bacteria is that for people who are immunocompromised, there's some risk of lung infection and associated problems. And so the biggest take-home is for those individuals. If you're immunocompromised, some kinds of water systems seem more risky than others. But there are also things people can do. For example, we're able to show that shower heads that are made of plastic seem to have less of this mycobacteria. And what we think might be happening is that the plastic is actually degraded by the microbes that make the biofilm that eat it. And so because there's a little bit of a food source, other bacteria that aren't the mycobacteria can start to outcompete the mycobacteria. And so in a way, what you're doing if you're using a plastic shower head may be to feed the good bacteria that are killing the mycobacteria that you don't want. And it's still early days of understanding it. So you do have a little bit of agency, though. You can swap out plastic for metal.
I'm still kind of hung up on the fact that bacteria actually excrete, that bacteria excrement is on our shower heads.
I mean, think of it as building, right? I mean, they just have this magical ability to make apartments with excretion. You know, but think of it mostly as construction and only a little bit as excretion.
So can you assure us that it's okay to take a shower, please?
It's okay to take a shower. It's a very, very low risk, and it's far less risky than, say, shaking hands with your neighbor.
Should we stop doing that?
No, you should do that too. We live in a world that's full of life, and we're always making decisions about how to avoid the very most dangerous things while still keeping contact with the rest of life. And, you know, I think we just have to acknowledge that we're surrounded by life and we need some moderation.
So a lot of people now use antibacterial soaps and hand sanitizers. Having studied all these microbes, what are they doing to the larger microbiome of our body and the microecology of our homes?
Well, so first of all, we know that soap and water, good old-fashioned soap and water, works great to kill pathogens that show up on your hands because you shook somebody's hand who was sick, or you know, after you go to the bathroom. And soap and water saves millions and millions of lives a year. But the advent of antimicrobial soaps was really solving a problem that didn't exist. Antimicrobial soaps don't ever work any better than good old-fashioned soaps. And in addition, those soaps seem not only to not do a better job of killing pathogens, they actually seem to favor some kinds of microbes that we really don't want. And so if you look on the pump itself of one of those antimicrobial soaps, there are often Pseudomonas bacteria living there that are tolerant of the antimicrobial soap and sort of get dished out every time you're using that soap. And so when you use the soap, you're essentially killing good bacteria and giving yourself a dose of not very good ones.
What are the not very good bacteria that live on those antibacterial soaps?
Well, I mean, the few studies that have looked at it very well found some Pseudomonas bacteria, which can cause a variety of infections and disease. But I'm sure if we look globally at antimicrobial soaps in different places, we're going to find different kinds of things living on them in different contexts. And so they're really a great example of where we've gone too far in trying to kill everything around us, and it's had unintended consequences. And that's a story that comes up again and again. We get scared by the idea that there's life around us. We try to kill all of it, and in doing so, we're more likely to make ourselves sick than well.
Cats and dogs. So many people have pets. What kind of microbiology do they introduce into our homes?
It's hard to know just exactly what sort of effects the dogs and cats and their microbes are having, and they can be very complex. But one of the things we see is that people, especially in urban environments with dogs, tend to have kids who are less prone to allergy and asthma. And one of the things that we think may be happening is that the dogs are actually a vehicle for the connection of those kids to just a little bit of nature. That in these environments in which we've isolated ourselves so much from the rest of the world, that the dirt on a dog's paw may be enough connection to forestall allergy and asthma at least a little bit. We don't see that effect with cats, but with dogs, it's pretty strong. And by the same token, dogs in rural environments seem to have less effect than allergy and asthma. And we think that's because in rural environments, you're getting so many other exposures to nature that the dog matters a lot less.
With cats, there's the fear of toxoplasmosis from cat feces, especially for women who are pregnant and people who have compromised immune systems. So tell us what you know about toxoplasmosis.
Yeah, so toxoplasmosis is caused by a parasite called Toxoplasma gondii that early on was studied mostly in people who studied cats and mice. It's a weird parasite in that it initially infects mice and rats and other rodents, and it can infect lots of kinds of mammals, but it can only have sex in cats. And so those things that it initially infects have to be eaten by a cat for the parasite to fulfill its hopes and dreams. And so early on, it was noticed that when mice were infected with this parasite, that they acted very differently. They ran much faster on their little wheels, and they seemed more prone to risky behavior. And so it started to be argued that, well, maybe the mice and rats and other animals that are infected, that their brains are actually being taken over by this parasite in ways that cause them to be more likely to be eaten by cats. And it was subsequently even shown that if rats or mice are infected by this parasite, that they're actually less afraid of the smell of cat pee. And so this thing that should be the scariest thing in the world to them suddenly is almost even kind of a little attractive. And so it's been shown that the part of what the parasite is doing is it's producing the precursor to dopamine in those rodents in their brain and somehow rewiring what they think and do. But for most of the history of the study of Toxoplasma gondii, That was a weird thing that happened in rats, mice, and cats that was interesting to basic biologists, but not relevant to humans. But then a few years ago, a Czech scientist named Jaroslav Pfleger had the idea that he personally had been infected by this parasite and that it had made him start to be risky. And he started to wonder if people in general, if they're infected with this parasite, that it changes their behavior. And what he would go on to show, and others have followed up on this, is that yes, in fact, if humans are infected by this parasite, they become more risky, they're much more likely to get into car accidents, their personality profiles actually change, so in some fundamental way you become a different human. And that would be interesting and obscure, except that in some countries, up to 70% of people are infected by this parasite that gets to them either through their cats or through eating meat that's not fully cooked. And so it's a crazy, crazy story, but it's also emblematic of when we study these thousands of species around us, they often have impacts that are far different or far greater than we could ever imagine.
I'm going to bring up now the German cockroach and ask how that figures into your study of the ecology of homes.
Yeah, so the German cockroach, we often talk about it as being indestructible.
Is that the standard really, cockroach, the German cockroach? Like, what separates the German cockroach from others?
It's the standard apartment cockroach. Mm-hmm. It's the cockroach that sort of most intimately lives with us. It's the movie cockroach. It's the
must we use the word intimately and cockroach in the same sentence?
Well, how about tightly rather than intimately? It's tightly connected to the ways in which we live, and so we think of it as indestructible, but. But if we cease to exist, it would be gone instantly, too. Its weakness is us. You know, it can withstand certain levels of atomic radiation. It can get really hot, really cold, but it can't live without us. But it's a really interesting species because it's one we've tried to kill again and again, and again and again it's outwitted us evolutionarily. And so the most recent outwitting event was that we make these roach baits that are simple sugar baits, sort of like the we bait the roaches to those baits the way that we bait our kids to cereal in the morning. We offer simple sugar, they come in. In the roach case, there's poison in the baits, and the roaches die. But a number of years ago, Jules Silverman, one of my colleagues, observed some roaches that just weren't interested in the baits. And, you know, he'd put out the baits, and they would just sort of walk around them. It was like they didn't care about sugar anymore. And what he was able to discover is they'd actually evolved a distaste for sugar. And recently it's been shown that they did that by basically rewiring the receptors in their brain to perceive sugar as disgusting. And so we imagine that, you know, we're just going to kill everything. But evolution is so amazingly fast and these species so committed in some way or another to living with us that we always lose in this game. Now we have roaches that we put out sugar and they just don't care.
So if you had roaches in your home, would you call in the exterminator?
Yeah, roaches are tricky. They're the one that I feel a little differently about. So German roaches, I would put out some of the new baits that they're still attracted to. There's a different sugar in them. And other roaches, if there aren't too many of them, I'd live peaceably with. And for the most part, you can control which species are in your home by which things are left around. You know, if there are little bits of food left around, it favors roaches. If you clear that food out, they become less and less common. And I mean, the other thing to notice is that lots of these roaches have enemies in your house, and so the spiders are helping to control the roaches. There's actually a teeny tiny wasp that we find in most houses that lays its eggs in the egg cases of the roaches, and then the little baby wasps crawl around and eat the living baby roaches and fly out.
Do they sting? And how big are they?
They don't sting. They're totally harmless. They just fly around your house doing good work on your behalf. And they're like an eighth of an inch long. They're teeny, teeny. And so even when they're there, you don't notice them.
What is the most surprising thing you've found in your own home?
When we started studying the insects in homes and other arthropods, if you would have asked me how many kinds of spiders were in my house, I would have said, well, there's the long, narrow one, and then there's the chubby one. And as we started studying homes, it became clear that no, I mean, almost nobody has just two kinds of spiders. Most houses have like 10 kinds of spiders. And my house was one of those houses. And so that was surprising. But here were all these kinds of spiders that were around me for a decade in my house, and I hadn't noticed them. And Matt Bertone, who's an entomologist at the university and can ID anything, went into my house to search for all the insects and other arthropods in my house. And he came back with a giant jar. It was like black with life. And I said, well, you've got 10 kinds of spiders, including one that's a spitting spider that doesn't build a web. It just sort of walks around and looks for fruit flies and spits venomous silk on them. And he found one of those in the stairwell going down to my basement. And there's still one there walking around. It's tiny. It's wonderful. And I'd never, ever noticed it. But once he saw it, then I could see it. But until he saw it, I was totally blind to it.
You know how a lot of people take probiotics that are, you know, capsules or through food like yogurt, things that have like the good guy bacteria so that you are creating in your gut a good bacterial environment instead of an imbalance of bacteria in your gut. Do you think someday there's going to be something similar to that for homes to create a good microbial ecology in your home?
Yeah, I hope so. It's not there now, but I look forward to a time when we can essentially garden our homes, fill them with species that benefit us and push out the species that don't. And the closest I think we come to that is in the context of making fermented foods. And so we study sourdough bread a lot. And when you make a sourdough starter, that starter has a bunch of microbes that produce lactic acid. And that lactic acid is key to the starter, but it also kills off any other bacteria. And so it's kind of a garden that weeds itself. And for me, that's a metaphor for what we'd like to have in our homes. A garden that benefits us, that's beautiful and wondrous and interesting, but also in some way weeds itself so we're not constantly going to war.
Well, Rob Dunn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Terry.
Rob Dunn is the author of the new book, Never Home Alone. He's a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has chosen his word of the year, and it connects to Donald Trump, who has revived a lot of old political phrases like enemy of the people and America first. But according to Jeff, Trump's most lasting contribution to our language might be in introducing the word nationalist into our political discourse. That's why Jeff's made nationalist his word of the year.
Donald Trump has a penchant for breathing new life into expressions with troubled pasts like America first and enemy of the people. It's not likely his uses of those phrases will survive his presidency. But he may have altered the political lexicon more enduringly at a Houston rally 2 weeks before the elections when he proclaimed himself a nationalist and urged his supporters to use the word. Given Trump's policies on immigration, trade, and foreign relations, future historians may very well label him a nationalist, like a number of other presidents before him. But no sitting president before now has ever described himself with that term. Theodore Roosevelt did campaign briefly after he left office for strengthening the national government under what he called the New Nationalism, with an 8-hour workday, an inheritance tax, and a ban on the sale of public lands. But over the following century, nationalism was indelibly tainted by the wars provoked by nationalist regimes in Europe and Asia. You can still use the word in a neutral way for the aspirational nationalisms in the post-colonial world, or secessionist movements in places like Catalonia and Scotland, peoples who are wishing for a nation, not exalting the one they already have. But when nationalism surfaces in developed states, it calls up images of militarism and xenophobia, jackboots and barbed wire, bombast and belligerence. It's all summed up by the disparaging adjective nationalistic, which is typically followed by words like propaganda and fanatic. The word's been rare in modern American politics. There were the black nationalists of the 60s and 70s, but theirs was an aspirational nationalism modeled on the wars of liberation in the developing world. The term white nationalism can sound aspirational, too. It conjures up separatist reveries of a nation reserved for persons of pallor. But it can slide into glorifying America itself as a white nation. The phrase has been simmering for decades on the fringes, but it's become ubiquitous in the last few years, When you see a media story that mentions nationalism in America these days, the odds are 9 to 1 the word will be preceded by white. So it wasn't surprising a lot of people heard Trump's avowal of nationalism as a shout-out to the white nationalists in his base, including a number of white nationalists themselves. David Duke tweeted that his nationalism and Trump's were fundamentally the same thing. Trump denied that he had any such connection in mind when PBS's White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor, who is African-American, asked him at his post-election press conference if his use of nationalism was emboldening white nationalists. He called the question itself racist. It's hard to know what he meant by that. Maybe that Alcindor was one of those people who see race everywhere. But then to hear Trump tell it, nationalism is just an ardent kind of patriotism, and nothing anyone who loves their country should object to. As he explained it to Laura Ingraham, "I'm proud of this country, and I call that nationalism. I don't see any other connotation than that." That's the kind of generic definition you get from a dictionary. It's useful when you want to suppress the historical associations of a word. You pluck it out of its context and pretend not to notice the dirt that's clinging to its roots. Nationalism seems just another of the words whose dark histories Trump has casually cast aside. He has to know by now that Enemy of the People evokes an all-star lineup of murderous despots like Stalin. That connection's been mentioned more than a dozen times on Fox News alone. And he's aware that America First is steeped in anti-Semitism. When Pat Buchanan used that slogan in his 1999 presidential campaign, Trump described him as a Hitler lover who was appealing to the wacko vote. But Trump insists that he's using those phrases in a brand new way. It may infuriate some of his critics, but presumably most of his supporters either don't know the word's history or don't really care about it. Trump's aware of the connotations of nationalist, too, which is why he's made a point of noting that we're not supposed to say the word. But unlike those other expressions, nationalism is haunted by multiple specters, all of them very present to the public's mind. The word evokes echoes of white nationalism, which Trump's indignant denials don't manage to dispel. It evokes vivid memories of the genocidal wars caused by the strident nationalisms of the past. And it allies him with the anti-democratic and xenophobic regimes that have arisen in Russia, Hungary, Poland, Italy, and now Brazil. At the ceremonies in Paris, marking the centenary of the end of World War I, in Trump's presence, French President Emmanuel Macron said that nationalism was a betrayal of patriotism and warned that old demons were resurfacing, ready to wreak chaos and death. That's a lot of baggage for a word to bear, and it hasn't been lost on Trump's adversaries. Columnists and prominent Democrats have been throwing the word back at him. It's become a Twitter meme to describe the Republicans as the nationalist party, which is something we've never had before in America. If that catches on, Trump will have managed to make nationalist a key word in the American political vocabulary for the first time in history. That might or might not be to his advantage, but it's reason enough to make nationalist the word of the year.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. After we take a short break, we'll hear from Steven Yeun, who played Glenn on The Walking Dead and stars in the new film, Burning. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Steven Yeun's big break was landing a role on the hugely popular zombie apocalypse show, The Walking Dead. Yeun played Glenn, a fan favorite. The Walking Dead is known for killing off its main characters, but Glenn did pretty well, lasting a full 6 seasons until his death, one of the show's more gruesome, in the premiere of season 7. Now Steven Yeun stars in the film Burning by Korean director Lee Chang-dong. Yeun plays Ben, a mysterious upper-class playboy in South Korea's capital, Seoul. He may or may not be murdering his girlfriends. Burning is based on a short story by Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami. Our film critic Justin Chang called the new movie the most absorbing movie he's seen this year. Yeun has also had roles in Okja and Sorry to Bother You. He was born in South Korea, but moved to the U.S. with his parents when he was 4. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Stephen Yeun, welcome to Fresh Air. So your character Ben in the movie Burning, he's very mysterious and, you know, he's open to the interpretation of the audience in a lot of ways. You can either read Ben as this kind of bored rich guy who kind of uses people, or you can read him as a potentially murderous psychopath. And the film never explicitly says which one he is. How do you approach playing someone like that?
I think the real key was that director Lee gave me a lot of my own freedom in approaching this character. But it really came down to director Lee said to me one day, maybe halfway through production, because we kept talking about the last scene, and he was saying, you know, you have to make that choice as an actor.
And about you will which make kind that of person he is.
Yeah, which kind of person he is. Yeah. And you will make that choice. And when we were done filming, he was like, what choice did you make? And I told him that I wasn't going to tell him. And so even to this day, I am the only one that knows who Ben really is.
So Lee Chang-dong said that your Americanness was an asset to this role, even though your character is Korean. So what did he mean by that? And how do you understand that?
Yeah. You know, when I first approached him, I was like, is Ben Korean-American? And he was like, no. He is a fully Korean person that lives in Korea. He might have traveled. He might know the Western world. He knows knowledge of the greater world, but he's not an Korean-American. And I was like, okay. So then I realized that I had a lot of work to do to, you know, really get and understand the encoding of the body of being a native currently living there Korean person. And for me as an immigrant, I know of Korea in kind of maybe images or eras. You know, my parents taught me Korea from the 80s to the 90s. That's their understanding of Korea, and that's how I grew up. But Korea's changed and evolved just like any other nation, and you're not updated on, you know, colloquialisms and vernacular and people's way of like just being with each other. And so I really thought that I had to do a lot of work with that. But he then said, let's not mess with your Americana that's kind of embedded into your body, the food that you've eaten, the choices that you've made, the way that you think. Don't alter those things. Instead, just let's work on the language so that you can be unequivocally Korean, but let's leave these mysterious Western encodings in your body alone. And I think that created its inherent kind of like dissonance with that character where you don't know who or what and where he's from.
The movie is in Korean. What challenges did that present to you?
Well, fortunately, my parents sacrificed their understanding of the English language by speaking only Korean at home so that I could maintain my Korean pronunciation. And so my pronunciation has always been pretty good. I wouldn't say great, but I would say it was good. I could probably pass for a native in Korea if I'm just talking to a cab driver. They wouldn't necessarily know from my voice. But it's missing the nuance and just the way that the specificities of how Korean natives speak. And so those were the things that I had to really get into. And also my reading comprehension and my vocabulary is not very great. And so I had a lot of work to do of just like really getting into the script, especially Ben. He speaks so, I guess, highbrow, very literarily.
When did you discover that you wanted to act?
I don't know if there was like a specific moment, but I think it came in college when I'd seen our school's improv group called Monkapult for our freshman orientation. And all I remember thinking was, I was like, that looks so fun. How do I do that? And I wish I could say that I made a conscious choice to pursue acting. But, you know, in the rear view, it really just seemed like I was just going like, I like this, so I'm going to do it. And then I kept liking and enjoying and growing. And I was like, I want to keep doing this. And then by the time I was done, I was all of a sudden moving to Chicago to try to get into Second City.
Which you did. So how old were you when you moved to LA?
I was 2009, I was 25.
So you started trying out for stuff, and I saw an early commercial of yours. It's this Milky Way commercial.
Oh,
well, you're like a swimmer, and you're about to dive backwards into the pool, and then you dive in, and you hear this squishy sound, and you've actually dove into a giant pool of caramel, and you're sort of, you look like a cockroach on your back, like stuck in this caramel, like squirming around. So first of all, that was all green screen, I'm assuming, right? You didn't actually jump in a caramel.
We jumped in an actual pool, and then they actually put us in a outdoor pool filled with caramel-like substance.
Some gooey stuff.
It was disgusting. It was my welcome to Hollywood moment, where it was like, this is going to pay for your bills and this is going to pay for your life while you're trying to make ends meet and hopefully get a job. But while you're doing this, like, we're going to put you in this vat and then afterwards we're going to hose you down with a high pressure hose in your Speedos in front of everybody. It was the most like self
ego check. You look so uncomfortable.
Oh my God. Yeah. The whole experience was uncomfortable. But when you're there and you're barely scrounging enough money to like live for the next day, you're like, spray me. Like, where do you need me to jump in?
Were there any auditions where the role you were trying out for was clearly a stereotype?
I only did it one time, which was in Chicago. There was this thing called Awesome 80s Prom. And I remember going in, they asked people to prepare an 80s monologue. And so I prepared Ferris Bueller's opening monologue, and I did it. And then after I finished, they were like, can you do that with an Asian accent? And I, you know, was so nervous that I was just like, I like half-assed a performance of speaking in broken English, and then I just walked out.
Because kind of you were in shock, kind of?
Yeah, well, you're also like, you know, back then, you know, nobody was really speaking up about this stuff, and so you're more like, is my agent going to be mad at me? Mm-hmm. Are these people never going to hire me? I don't even know what's possible for me, but I'm already going into a place where it's like I have to be so brave and I don't even have any credits to my actual name.
Mm-hmm.
I remember calling my agent back and just being like, listen, I don't, they actually wanted to hire me. And I was like, I don't want to do this. Like,
did the agent know that that's what they wanted?
Yes, of course.
And hadn't told you?
And hadn't told me. Yeah. And, I was like, I'm not doing it. And I remember the agent being really angry at me, being like, you know, this person is pissed off that you came in and wasted their time and did this audition when you aren't even going to do it. And I'm like, I, you know, that was just different times.
Well, your big breakthrough, obviously, was getting the role of Glenn on The Walking Dead, the hugely popular zombie apocalypse TV show. You were on the show for 7 years. Recently, you said that while you were, you know, super grateful to have that role, that as the years went on, you felt a bit cramped by Glenn as a character, and you described him as beige, like kind of a bland person. Can you explain that?
I wish I could always, you know, use better choice of words when describing things. And I, you know, I hope people that might have heard that didn't think I was hating or didn't like. But I think it was just, you know, a lot of factors. I think it was, you start at 25, you're 26, and then you grow to, you know, 32, 31, and you're not the same person that you were.
Mm-hmm.
When you embody a character for as long as you do, you tend to outgrow them unless they're able to grow with you. You know, the concept of even an Asian American person and a man has morphed and changed even in the last decade by a lot. You know, there's moments where people were super psyched that an Asian man was in a relationship with a white woman, and that was like a big point of victory for a moment. And then you evolve from there and you go, oh, like, that's also its own trap where you're not looking at these people like humans. You're instead justifying these identifiers, these ethnicity things that really shouldn't necessarily be celebrated in that way. And so as you kind of process those ideas and grow as an individual, playing a character that seems like it's written in a specific way seems a little bit, you know, claustrophobic sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it was just a natural growing process of being the age that I was and the character and the show and a lot of things kind of coming together at the same time.
Well, I can't imagine that this is a spoiler at this point, but your character, Glenn, dies. Mm-hmm. It's a very gruesome death. as most people know, the show was adapted from a comic book. And although the show doesn't exactly follow the comic, you know, there's a lot of similarities. There's some major plot points that come from the comic. And in the comic, your character, Glenn, was beaten to death by a baseball bat covered in barbed wire. And it's really horrifically depicted in the comic. And so as you were playing Glenn, did you have in the back of your mind that this fate was at some point coming to you? Like, did they tell you early on that that was going to be your end? Or did you get a script one day that was like, this is your last script?
I remember Scott Gimple, who's an incredible human.
Who's a showrunner.
Showrunner at the time. He was gracious enough to sit me down even a couple of years prior to... And, you know, we were friends, so we would just be like, I'd just be like, Scott, you know, this death is going to come at some point. And, I think it has to be me. It has to happen. And he's like, yeah, you know, you never know when it's going to happen. You never know if it'll happen, or you never know who it's going to happen. I can't promise you that. But then as we kept coming closer and closer, I kind of advocated for it in that way. Not because, you know, I wanted to be off the show, but because it was the end. It's written. And so that's kind of how I approached it. And Scott was really gracious to give me that headway and that lead time. And yeah, it was not a shock. It was kind of just easing into that moment.
You told your parents that you wanted to try to pursue an acting career. And they sounded like they were disappointed, but they were supportive and gave you like 2 years at it. Is that...
Yeah, I think they knew who their son was. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they do, which is like a hot-headed, like really stubborn person. And so they knew that, you know, I was just going to do it whether they liked it or not. And so, you know, they reluctantly gave me their blessing, but not without like...
An ultimatum.
Yeah, they gave me 2 years and they're like, you know, you got 2 years to try to do this. And then they made me get a job, which I miserably failed at while I was over there. And,
what was that?
It was inside sales at a IT consulting firm.
That's good.
That was horrible.
That's good experience for your role, and sorry to bother you.
Yeah, very much so. Again, my parents just doing a solid for me every time. I really am going to owe them my entire career, which I do.
So was there a point when they were like, okay, you're an actor now?
I think it really happened when I got Walking Dead. Before then, they were happy to see me doing Second City and things like that, but they were always in the rear view, like, you know, go to LA, hurry up so you can just get this out of your system and come back and be a doctor. And I went to LA and I booked this show, and you know, my dad cried on the phone when I got it, and you know, he was just like so relieved. Never did we know that it would turn into what it's turned into.
Did they watch The Walking Dead?
Oh yeah, they did.
Was it really horrifying for them to watch your death?
I don't think my mom's watched my death, actually. My mom is still yet to watch my death. And then my dad, you know, he just thinks it's funny. He's just like,
there's nothing
what?
Funny about that scene.
Yeah, he's just like, what did you do? He's like, what did you make? He's like, what a wild show.
Well, there's something really interesting that you said about this, is that, your parents took this huge risk to move to the United States. Mm-hmm. And so they're risk takers, and so they sort of let you continue taking risks by accepting that you wanted to act.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, I met with K.W. Lee one time, who is the first Asian American journalist to write for a major publication. I think when I met him, he was in his mid-90s. Mm. Incredible human being, mouth of a sailor, hilarious. He told me, never forget second generation sacrifices too. And I was just like blown away. Because I was resting all my of myself on my parents' sacrifice to be like, oh, you guys did it. You guys were the risk takers so that you could get me this chance to be here. And when he said that, it made me really realize, like, and I was having my kid and I was just like, okay, like, I have to risk too. I have to put my neck out on the line. I have to sacrifice in that way too, to give more semblance of freedom for my child. And so, yeah, I think that extension of that like crazy decision to deconstruct a life that was fine. You know, we're not refugees. We're not forced out of our country. My dad just made a decision to leave because he took a business trip one time to Minnesota in the early 80s and thought that it was so great.
Must not have been in the winter time.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think he just saw land. And he was like, you can own land like this? And so he was like, I want to try it. And, you know, I know the story that we get told oftentimes, which is true in the end, but what we get told is that it was all done as a sacrifice to us. But really, you know, it's just a human's way of like taking that risk to try to make something greater for themselves. And my dad came over on his own ambitions with my mother and brought his kids. And then eventually it did become a sacrifice because, you know, the parameters by which he was able to succeed were also limited because he's an immigrant. And so he succeeded as best as he could. And it would have been, I think, foolish and kind of wasteful of me to take that boldness and just bury it and say, I'm just going to be safe because you guys took the risk. And instead I said, let me do what you did.
Well, Steven Yeun, thanks so much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Steven Yeun stars in the new film Burning. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.